welcome to AFP. My name is Devang Desai, and I'm joined by the usual suspects, David Goss and Nick Andrade. On today's show, we chat. It went to Rome. Argentina and Messi get their trophy, and the Gold Cup is back. Gentlemen, what a weekend. Cup finals everywhere. The drama, super intense. But David, first, how was the vacay?
Oh, it was great. I had my girlfriend's family visit me, which was stressful. So that's fun. No, I'm just kidding. It was great. And then I went to Texas for a week for MLS Next. The next in MLS. That's the tagline. That's not really. I just made that up.
How many Nexts did you see? How many Nexts did you run into?
A lot. A decent amount. And yeah, it was pretty cool. I haven't really been to a soccer game in a while, like sit there and watch. And so I was down there watching 4 or 5 games a day from the field side. And so that's pretty sweet. It was like cool to finally have that experience again and, you know, get around the actual sport and not just have to watch it on TV. So that was pretty awesome. And in the past when I've gone, I mean, the list of players I've seen, it's pretty impressive that, you know, Efra Alvarez, Gio Reyna, Weston McKennie, like those are the guys I've seen down there in the past. So I would assume there's more of them in there. I can't predict them. If I could, I'd have more money than I do now. But yeah, so it was a good time. And then I came back to New York, the home of Italy. And I have gone Rome, basically. I am in Italia. Forza Sori.
Wow. So, you sent us a video in the group chat of a street entirely blocked off in New York to celebrate the Italian win. To be expected, I guess, as you said, second home of Italians, one of the biggest spots, New York City. Was it lit, as they say?
Yeah, it was. And it was like all over the city because like this was downtown. But then I had friends out in deep Queens or deep Brooklyn where they're, you know, pretty heavily Italian neighborhoods where it was the same videos I was seeing on Instagram of actual Italy. It was like the same setup.
Yeah.
So like, oh yeah, I guess this is a pretty Italian city. So that was pretty fun. I don't normally root for Italy, but I don't root for England. So it was like kind of lesser of two evils. So it was like the one time that me and the evil empire could combine and both be happy.
Nick, how did you take in these games? Did you go to a viewing party or chill at home?
No, I was at home. I watched it with my girlfriend and I was cheering for England because I don't know. There's a big rivalry in the GTA between Portuguese people and Italians. So you never want to see Italy win. But there is, Devang knows.
It's true.
You know what? After Portugal won in 2016, I'm a little bit less on the rails about it. So I was happy for Italy, but I was devastated for those kids taking the penalties, to be honest. And seeing, you know, some of the racial abuse that they've been getting online. I tweeted this yesterday. It was like, you know, whoever misses these penalties, and I understand why people don't want to take penalties sometimes because you're going to be lambasted in history for the next 30 years and you're going to be memed to shit. And it's just unfortunate the way that people can't be civil about these games.
Yeah, I was going to remark before the events of yesterday or Sunday transpired that like it was a bit different going into these games because I really was a neutral. Like I had some vested interests and of course Bukayo Saka being an Arsenal guy, I hope to see him do well. But I really was just watching these games for the fun of it, including the Euro final, which to the very last kick, I enjoyed it. I'm like, I'm having a good time. And then Bukayo got up and didn't score. And it went from okay to maybe the worst possible ending of all time. And you mentioned the abuse and hopefully those idiots are sanctioned and they get the support they need, those players. And I think so far we've seen some good stuff. But man, what a weird ending. And it kind of sucked, to be honest. Like it kind of took the wind out of the sails for me.
So more upset for you, Saka missing the penalty or Emi Martinez saving like 19 penalties and being the best goalkeeper in the world.
So the Emi Martinez discourse is also poisonous because Bryan Leno is probably also leaving. So there's a lot of revisionist history. But yeah, I mean, I think generally it's a scouting fail and I have nothing against Emi. So I'm happy to see him do well for Argentina and help Leo get that trophy. So that's less scouting. I think it's how this game goes. Like Saka has a breakup performance and he's the darling of the tournament. And then the game works in funny ways and we end up with a bit of a sour taste, right? But I think he'll respond. He's a wonder kid. Everyone speaks so highly of him, but it just really sucked to see it end that way for those guys. And if anyone knows what that's like, it's Gareth Southgate. So I feel like it's such a, man, England gonna England and the scenes at Wembley and fans rushing into the stadium. I'm like, this is just a calamitous end to a really good month of football.
But hey, guess what? Liverpool are back in training. So this is great news.
Lord. Good Lord. All right. Well, we'll skim over that quickly. Before we move on, a reminder, we are on patreon.com/afootballpodcast. We'd like to shout out Francesco for joining us. Thank you very much, my friend. If you want to be like Francesco and join us, right? Forza Azzurri, as they say. I'm not doing the accent because I don't want to offend anyone. But
Francesco is Italian, by the way. I was just saying it in an accent. That's on you, Devang.
Even worse. If you sign up, you get the show ad free. You can join us on the Discord. We're this Gold Cup now, so we're chatting that all the time. What else? You get the show early as well on Mondays after we record. It's a good deal. So head on over to patreon.com/afootballpodcast and join today. When we come back, we chat Euro 2020 final and the Copa America final. History all over the place coming up next.
Pressure on a 19-year-old. And now Italy win. They're European champions for only the second time, 53 years after the first. A long wait is over for the Azzurri, but not for England. It's deja vu for Gareth Southgate.
There you have it, a crushing end for England. Jubilation for Italy. David, I think we can safely say, maybe for one of the few times ever, that the team that played the best ended up winning the tournament. Is that, are you willing to say that Italy was the best team at Euro 2020?
I hadn't thought about it that way overall for the tournament, just had I had for the final, but I think you're right. One, I don't think we can say very often that Italy was the team that played the best in the tournament. Like that's the shocking part about how this played out. And so I think it's huge credit to Roberto Mancini just to, I was talking to some of the Italy fans yesterday and I was saying, you know, obviously Chiellini, right, with the way he was with Azpilicueta going into that penalty kick shootout. And then he's made a couple comments sort of trolling England and everyone's like, why would you give them bulletin board material? And I think it was job done for Italy before they even got to the final, because I think the key to the last few years was to just restore hope in the national team to recreate the culture of the Azzurri, and they had already done that. They'd reset the way they played, but I think they had reset the belief in that group, and it's only going to get better. And so I actually looked at this final as Italy this year was where England was in 2018, which was a lot of young pieces with some veterans that will cycle out, but more hope going forward than necessity to win at that moment. But you also don't get to a semifinal and a final very often. So when you look at, you know, what's happened with Belgium, you don't want to waste those opportunities. And then, yeah, I think Italy was the one who tried to play the entire tournament and they were poor against Austria. But outside of that, they were the best team throughout the competition and they deserved to win this game. And I don't think England did much to deserve to win this actual final. And you could argue that that's how they played actually throughout most of the tournament. And we could get into it. But Devang, I think that's a fair assessment to me.
Right. And I think like after 4 minutes, Gareth Southgate looks like a genius because the wingbacks combine to score earlier. And I thought Kieran Trippier was one of the best players in the first half. And Luke Shaw has been one of the best players of the tournament. And you saw their contributions there. So for that reason, you have to applaud maybe how they started. But I think the old adage, and it's mostly bullshit, but maybe they did score too early because it seemed like England kind of sat not only back, but I want to say they rested on their laurels that they built throughout this tournament where they were extremely strong defensively. And perhaps they thought that was enough against an Italy side that though they were progressive offensively, they lost Spinazzola and they were no longer as threatening perhaps as they were earlier in the tournament. Maybe they thought that would be enough. And I think we've seen it so many times before. It wasn't going to be. I'm less harsh on Gareth Southgate for that, I think, as I am for maybe the substitutions later in the match. If you want to get guys like Sancho and Rashford ready for the penalties, get them on earlier. But he's worried they're going to concede if they're too wide open. So I think he was trapped in the rigidity that I think brought him so much success. So by the end, it almost failed him. And I think that's where England has to look at how they go forward, because obviously they have almost every piece you need to play either way. And they can play offensively a little more like Italy did, right? So I think maybe that's something they can build from this.
So I don't want to argue myself out of logic and what's in front of me, but I think when you look at the way this tournament laid out, it's almost like England should have been where they were. They played home the entire group stage. Mm-hmm. And then the way the bracket fell, they clearly had an easy path. I'm shocked Ukraine got as far as they did. That was as easy a quarterfinal as you're ever going to get. Denmark was a tough game, and I thought Denmark actually had a really good first half, and they rested on their laurels. They sat back when they shouldn't have instead of taking control of that game. But Denmark, rather than playing Spain or Italy in a semifinal, is a difference, especially, again, at home. And so you look at the way this tournament played out, and I don't know that they ever played to their strengths. I don't know that they ever played to their peak, for sure, of what they could. And so then you come into this final, and I think Gareth Southgate is scared to let the game open up. And he's probably not wrong in international competition, right? It's single games, knockout situations. You want as much control as you can get. But that's where I question him going forward. From a psychological, cultural point of view, he's been phenomenal for England. He's given an opportunity to a lot of young players. He's created, I think, a safe environment for them to feel confident to play for England, to, you know, play their game, to go out there. But he doesn't want the game to open at all. And I think me and Nick have talked about this the entire tournament. As we've discussed England, he plays two defensive midfielders. Everyone he started with in the tournament was possession heavy players because he didn't want the game to open up. Then Foden struggled. Then he started to bring in other players. But even in Saka, who has been phenomenal, Devang, this is a guy who you're playing at wing who's played a ton of fullback. So yeah. I think that there's that level of safety with him. And then you come into the final and the wingbacks worked because they were just too wide. Their shape was too wide for Italy. And you saw, I mean, that opening goal, Kane turns upfield and he could have hit the ball anywhere for Trippier. Like, he's so wide open down the right side. No one closes him down. He's able to cross it for Shaw. And they continued to find that success for like 15 minutes and then they turned it off. So I think that there's a lot of question marks around the way England plays under Gareth Southgate. I don't think there's question marks in terms of his ability to manage the group through this tournament.
It's funny, looking at the Italy team, Donnarumma got player of the tournament, and I mean, you saw what he did in the penalties, and just his presence on the team was obviously massive, and it's hard to quibble with that. But just looking around, I think there's just a couple guys that probably could have been shouted out for this. I mean, Chiesa in the final alone, I thought single-handedly willed Italy back into this game with his marauding runs and kind of picking up for an immobile Immobile, who almost did nothing at all through the entire game. But Verratti was incredible. Jorginho was great. Bonucci, Chiellini. I was wondering who stood out for you field players wise, DG?
I would say all of those. In terms of player of the tournament, obviously Chiellini getting hurt and Verratti starting hurt doesn't help. Chiesa not even starting to open up the tournament doesn't help as well. I thought Insigne was great again. I think he's a world-class attacker, and I think this tournament's been awesome for everyone to see that. He shouldn't have to leave Napoli for everyone to understand that. That's a high enough level that he's proved himself at. In my mind, and I've thought this for years, so I'm glad that he's, I think, getting his due as the star attacker of this group. So I think all of them were phenomenal, and I think when you look at this Italian performance, they were able to protect the things Chiellini and Bonucci don't do well. And then that set the stage for them to kind of push forward and get into possession. And the big fear for me was, well, as Italy turns the ball over, now you've got Sterling, you've got whoever else running at Bonucci and Chiellini. And except for one time, it didn't happen. So for Italy, I think the spacing, the way they handled their midfield worked out perfectly.
Well, it's a wrap, David. It's done. A month flew by, but it's time to make our... I know. And I think I'll miss the daily distractions from midday mundaneness and having something to do and have something to watch and have great stuff to watch. Frankly, I think I was surprised at the level of the players, given how much they had played and overall just the wear on their tires. But what's the most memorable moment for you guys? And Nick, I'll bring you in here, because I think we'd be remiss not to mention Christian Eriksen to begin this tournament and like where we started and where we ended up, and that moment of just frank tragedy, and then to move on from that and Patrick Schick's golazo and France getting stunned by Switzerland. What was the moment of the tournament for you guys?
Interesting. I was unprepared for this. I would say, obviously, just like the 12 hours after the like miracle that was Christian Eriksen surviving was pretty amazing. And then you get to see like the outpouring of the world and community and all that stuff. So I thought that was pretty incredible. But in terms of games, there's like, it's impossible to, I mean, remember Sweden, Poland to close out? Like there was like two goals in stoppage time of that game. And that's just a random one. To bring up, obviously, the France-Switzerland double with the Croatia game, where those two games were both two-goal deficits that went to penalty kicks, and those teams ended up losing, you know, in the same day. That's probably one of the wildest days of watching this sport that I've ever had in my entire life.
Yeah, I agree, especially like just seeing Ukraine, the Czech Republic, Switzerland all making, you know, the quarters, and it's like, well, okay, well, did we even predict that? Not really. And the bracket just became, you know, completely busted by so many of these teams. Like France underperformed. That's always great to see. It's I don't mean it in a bad way. I'm just saying, like, it's great to see, you know, dark horses and underdogs make it far in tournaments, and I'm excited to see what the World Cup holds for that specifically. But man, you could just see with knockout tournaments like this, if you play a certain style, or if, you know, a certain player gets hot, like Patrick Schick, seeing how he played throughout the tournament, you know, you never know what's going to happen. I love that drama of these kind of tournaments. And although, you know, we think two of the best teams ended up making the final, it was just a fun tournament to watch overall, and I had a blast.
It's well said. I think, you know what, I'll remember the day Granit Xhaka was universally beloved for one time only, because that will never happen again, for sure. But it did. It actually did. Wonderful tournament in the books. It's funny, in the end, Cristiano Ronaldo somehow won the golden boot based on some egregious tiebreakers, Nick, I guess, that were decided in Lisbon. Yeah. I don't know how they came up with this.
We know that own goal actually should have won the golden boot, right?
Oh, the own goal going for 80 million. Arsenal has bid 80 million, but I'm not sure if they'll secure that. But I think it's ironic or interesting that Ronaldo, CR7 gets that award as we move to South America and the other massive tournament going that was decided over the weekend. Lionel Messi going for his first major international trophy, Argentina going for their first Copa America since 1993. An international team much maligned, possibly just as much as England in terms of not getting it done when it counts. I think I heard Gonzalo Higuain missing huge goals mentioned at least 80 times throughout this tournament, which wasn't that long, but justifiably so, based on the fact that Lionel Messi hasn't signed a new contract and there's much intrigue about one of the best players ever. Obviously, this was a tournament to watch, even though there was no fans, and it was definitely a weirder Copa America than usual, but they got it done. DG at the Maracana, 1-0, Angel Di Maria, the guy, right? Of course it was going to be someone else other than Leo Messi, but I guess in the end, that's what he really needed. Someone else to step up when it counted.
Well, if you remember, Di Maria was hurt for the 2014 World Cup final, where he was the second best player on the team throughout that run. I think this was, if he was healthy, they probably would have won that World Cup. Like, he needed someone else to step up, Messi did, but he also needed Di Maria. And I think he's missed two of the three finals they've been in. So that's what Di Maria is, a generational player. He, you know, he's the Grincha, I think, of this time of like, yeah, everyone's going to talk about Messi forever. And then you're going to bring up Di Maria in 15 years and no one's going to know who he is. And then you're going to bring up his resume, his highlights, his stats. And he was one of the great players of his time period. He just was the other Argentine during that time. And so it was cool to see that he was the one who scored the goal. When Messi didn't put away that chance in the 90th minute,
I was worried.
I was like, you got to be kidding me. This is how this whole thing's going to go. Like, Brazil goes down the other way and you're like, you've no way. But I think, as most people that weren't Brazilian, I think we're happy for Messi. Maybe not Nick. That might not be true.
No,
but we're happy for Messi. You know, it doesn't change anything about who he is as a player to me, but it clearly does to other people. And so if it makes it easier, why not to have that argument? And I think it was pretty cool for Argentina. We came into this tournament and it's like, well, what's a positive from this? This was a tough tournament to get around. Euros was as well, you know, in the time period that we're in. But to move from Colombia, because it's in political unrest, because their government is corrupt, to Argentina, which has one of the highest COVID rates in the world, to Brazil, which has a worse COVID rate than
and a worse
Argentina,
government, arguably.
And has political unrest because its government is miserable. So just, rather than co-host, why not just fuse it all in one? And then you have the group stage, which eliminated two teams after all those games, which I kind of had trouble getting behind with no fans. But then you got into the knockouts, and Copa America is a great tournament. The last few years, it's been this Peruvian group, which is playing like no Peru group has ever played before. That's been fun to watch. A Colombia team that still has Cuadrado in it, still has that heart that they play with. But now you've got all the guys from Atalanta and some young players coming through that were really exciting to watch as well. And then Argentina, I think, growing as the tournament went along, getting more and more comfortable. And it's interesting. These teams haven't played a ton together because of COVID. And it while you had Otamendi, you had Di Maria, you had Messi, there was a lot of newer pieces that got a ton of time and a ton of responsibility in this group. And I think that's what was interesting to watch for Argentina come together, because they were a mess in 2018. Sampaoli's a mess, but they were a mess as a team. And this is a whole different group that's tight defensively, that can play in possession when they have to, and then create dangerous opportunities.
I feel like Angel Di Maria's shine or his luster was really, it took a blow from that Manchester United foray, and generally everyone around the club at that time kind of suffered the similar thing. But like he was rated highly, I think, going into that move, and then it obviously didn't work out, but everyone coming out of that didn't look great.
Can I just say, he was Ronaldo's foil. And if you look at Real Madrid, all those Champions League victories, there were Champions League runs where he was the best player on Real Madrid. They were a team that was based in strength, right? They had Sergio Ramos at the back. They had great goalkeeper. Like, they weren't a team that blew teams off the field, and that's where you looked at them. But he was the best player on that team in multiple Champions League runs. I forgot he even had played at Man U. Then he goes to PSG and makes another Champions League final with a club that had never made it before.
Shout out to Luis Diaz as well, having a massive tournament for Colombia. I know Colombia fans are really excited about him and his performance. The final itself, I mean, not a great game. And I think maybe the biggest highlight might be Neymar and Messi embracing on the field afterwards. That relationship, I think, is interesting. I mean, I don't know how much gossip you want to go off of, but they seem super tight. And I feel like there is a reunion coming in the future. Where? I have no idea. Ooh. But I was very intrigued by that. Yeah.
You think Toronto FC?
Listen, we only go bigger DP-wise. Shoot for the moon. Brazil-wise, though, I mean, like, they're doing well in qualifying. It seems like Tite will survive till at least the next round of games. But you host the tournament. You're expected to win. You're Brazil. You don't lose in this tournament very often. But the final, really, I mean, it seemed like a rugby match at times, and it worked out in Argentina's favor. But nothing really to write home about for them.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think the game flow wasn't the way Brazil wants it. And obviously they'll have to deal with this. But I think in a World Cup, unless you're playing a very specific opponent that you have a higher level of talent against, it's not really how the game will be played. Although, in fairness, they destroyed Belgium in the last World Cup and they weren't able to break through for the goal. So maybe this is the problem for Brazil. You just look at it and it's every one of their center forwards starts for one of the best teams in the world, and none of them can score goals. Gabriel Jesus wasn't available, but has struggled for City at times. Obviously, we know what Roberto Firmino does as a player, and he can do those things for Brazil, but again, doesn't score goals. So now you're looking at Paqueta and Richarlison and Neymar, and they're all super goal dangerous, but none of them are a true center forward. And that's the one thing I think Tite's still trying to figure out. As the rest of this group's pretty solid, they're going to have to find a replacement for Thiago Silva, but I think they already have them on the books. I mean, they've got center backs that start for Real Madrid and everything else in Champions League. So I don't think they're far off there, but I agree with you that Tite should be fine. It's a disappointing final, and I think the way they've gone out of these last two tournaments have both been disappointing, but that's like that last... I get it's Brazil, and they expect to win everything, but Dunga wasn't even doing that. And so you're already further than you were a few years back when everyone thought, you know, the national team was a mess and a tragedy and all similar stuff to I said about Italy. They've already moved past that. Now it's just about that final step getting over.
Two massive tournaments in the books in the blink of an eye. Wow. What the hell? What day is it? Where are we? July. Yeah, July something. Incredible. David, anything else? Anything to wrap that we missed on
these
tournaments?
Not really. I mean, it sucks that all this had to happen this way, you know, but then it's also kind of epic that it all happened at the same time. I will say I love the international game. I think I like it more than club, but part of what makes it great is when it's rare. So like, I hope the feeling coming out of this is like, oh, well, we should just have a summer championship every year and we should just throw 24 teams in every competition or 54 teams in every competition. I hope that's not the blowback of this whole thing. And I hope it's that we now can reset the calendar and kind of space things out, because I think you mentioned it, like, a little bit surprising, the energy in Euros for all these players that have played so long. And I think it's because of the novelty and excitement to represent your country and be with that group of people that a lot of times that you've grown up with, but you're not around all the time. And to do something different than what your club opportunity is. But I don't think that's the case if they have to play a tournament like this every single summer. You know, if it's, well, Nations League, let's actually build it out into a full tournament. So then it's Nations League, Euros, World Cup, Copa America's now moved to every 2 years from 4 years. Gold Cup's obviously every 6 months. AFCON as well, every single year. So it's, I love these tournaments and these games, but you need to space it back out when you get this opportunity.
Well, you're in luck, David, because we have the totally normal Qatar World Cup coming up at a normal date and time and a normal place in the calendar.
November 21st, 2022.
Get ready for that.
I will say I'm stoked about the, let's be real, everyone turns off from like the middle of November to end of December. So to have that combined with a World Cup is going to be, and like crazy morning one, like it's going to be here in the US, for example, we have Thanksgiving for, you know, it's like a whole week where people are not working. Now you throw a World Cup into that. That's pretty sweet.
Should be good. Atrocities aside and human rights violations aside, but we gloss that over. All right.
Coming up next, Thanksgiving or Qatar?
Thanks. Both, to be frank, both. All right. When we come back, we head to North America. The Gold Cup has kicked off. Canada begins with a win over Martinique. We talk Canada, USA, and the rest coming up next on AFP.
Buchanan turns on the afterburners. Buchanan across, and he lets it in. Jonathan Osorio. Oh, so good. Buchanan can't be stopped. And Canada, just like that, a 2-1 lead.
I think you could hear the snicker laughter from color commentator Terry Dunfield, former Canada international, on that call. And rightfully so, because Tejon Buchanan was doing that kind of stuff all day against Martinique in a new role for him as the Canadian national team is back in action at the Gold Cup. No Alfonso Davies, no Jonathan David, MLS heavy squad. But I think all eyes have turned to Tejon Buchanan, who's lighting it up for the Revs. And now the national team, David, the banter is now increasing to critical mass as we think about Europe and what's potentially next. But I want to ask, is it us hyping too much or is this real? Are you buying it from across the border?
Yeah, I'm buying it. You're talking about Tejon or you're talking about the team?
Tejon specifically.
Okay, yeah, I'm buying with Tejon. And I've been a fan of his for a while, but I thought people were too quick because he has so many tools. That the moment he was effective as a right back in the one game in the playoffs last year, everyone was like, whoa, he's going to Europe. He's a game changer. I still needed to see it more consistent. I still need to see that mindset. Even though he wasn't super successful, I thought the Olympic qualifying was big for him to be the star of that team and to be able to continue to perform, even though all defensive eyes were on you, was really big. And then he's come back and he's, you know, kept big time European signings out of the starting lineup with the Revs because of how he's played. And he is key and integral to one of the two best teams in Major League Soccer. And now you're seeing it with Canada. So I'm super high on him. He's doing it now on both wings. He's dangerous with both feet, so he can go either way. And he's quick enough that if you give him an opening, he's going to get there. And you've seen him become way more decisive in what he does when he gets around the 18. And I think you saw that a ton in this Martinique game to create those opportunities. So I'm really high on him. My guess how it plays out long term is that he finishes the season in Major League Soccer. The Revs are not a club that's really sold that much. mm-hmm. and especially not despite their winning as a group. So my guess is they either agree something and get him to stay loaned back, or they just sell him to go over in January.
It's interesting. I was asked this a couple of times over the weekend as well, like, where would it make sense for him to go for his development? And I definitely don't think maybe we're talking about a Premier League just yet, but maybe Belgium or France, something like that. But the world feels like his oyster much in the same for Richie Larea, and like what he could potentially do after the season as well, whether it be Besiktas or somewhere else. But that's promising from the wingbacks. I think the midfield as well against Martinique was pretty solid. I know Marc-Anthony Kay had a mistake for the first Martinique goal, but he recovered well. And Oso and Eustachio added goals and looked decent. But I think it's fair to say, like, it was pretty hard to gauge where this Canada team is at against a pretty weak Martinique side, not a side that you can measure yourself against, especially considering who Canada is going to play in the coming days. But I mean, good enough. And I think the blow before the tournament started with Alphonso Davies and Jonathan David beforehand not being available, you knew you were going to get a different look from this Canada team. But I think equally as important as those guys long term, it's what can you get from Theo Corbanu, or what can you get from Lucas Cavallini and Samuel Piet and Liam Fraser, MLS guys, regular guys? What could you get from them down the road in the World Cup qualifier? So obviously important games, but you watched it all. DG, anyone for Canada specifically stand out to you outside from Tejan?
Tejan was the big one. I would say another good performance along the back line for Alistair Johnston is big, because I think his athleticism to get out and cover along the wing when the wing back goes higher up the field, which is where they create a ton of the width in this system, is necessary. And we've seen now managers across the world kind of slide a fullback in as one of the three center backs, but the one that kind of then has to go out and defend as a fullback. Obviously, Kyle Walker does it for England and for Manchester City, and a bunch of other teams do that now too. So another good performance from him, I think, was pretty key. And you mentioned that midfield, the domination, the way they can play. I don't know how this translates to like high level World Cup qualifying games, but I will say my feeling is that this game would not have been as easy for Canada over the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. This would have been a win, but it wouldn't been, especially when they went down 1-0, you wouldn't say, oh, well, for sure they're going to come back. So while that may not translate immediately to World Cup qualifying, I think it does translate to getting to a hex. I think it does translate to getting deeper in gold cups. And I don't think there's enough defensive strength in this midfield to start it on the road in World Cup qualifying, let alone at home. But I think it's key to be able to win games like this the way they did.
Canada starts well. The other teams in this group, USA and Haiti. Can I just say, and I know this has little to do with sports, but like honestly, there's a pretty huge connection, but I found it really bizarre that Haiti played this game at all after the president was just assassinated. And there's like random implications that multiple international countries are involved and the players are clearly shook by this, but it's like, all right, let's play the Gold Cup. I know their keeper said they got to put it behind them and play for the nation, but I found that super jarring on a obviously terrible week and weekend for Haiti.
Yeah, and then 12 hours before the game, five players tested positive for COVID that were out of the team. And so including, I think, at least two, if not three starters. So then you add that to everything as well. I think they played really well. Like they should have been ahead 1-0 or 2-0 even before the U.S.'s early goal. Etienne should have equalized it at 1-1. And then the second half, Haiti came out on the front foot and they pushed the game and they pressed the U.S. and they created chances and they were more dangerous. So I thought it was a really impressive performance from Haiti. I agree with you. It's chaos. I mean, this whole thing's chaos, right? Curaçao just got pulled out of the tournament.
Right.
And then Guatemala got put in, but didn't have enough time to even get to the game they were supposed to play in. So they had to move it back a day and all the fans got tickets for basically a 48-hour experience. The whole thing makes no sense. So I agree with you, Devang, but hats off to the Haitian players for the way they were able to perform.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, I think less so in the Canada-Martinique sense, but USA, this team, similar to Canada in the MLS heavy contingent, you're missing the European stars, but a lot of guys that we're super interested in, Matthew Poppy's here, Eric Williamson, your guys here, Gianluca Busio, who could be going... to Serie A anytime soon is here. But for the Canadians and myself included, we have circled this USA game. And I'm looking on paper, and perhaps this is me being a bit too optimistic, but do you see a huge gulf in the two squads that have been brought here, respectively, by USA and Canada? I don't see a huge one.
No, I don't think so either. This is a US team that has a bunch of holes in the way they can play. They basically have no wingers. Paul Arriola went out injured yesterday. Him and Jonathan Lewis are only the true natural wingers on this team. There isn't a ton of just natural creativity as well. Like, it has to be quick ball movement, good runs, stuff like that out of Greg Berhalter's system to create chances. So it's not a super dangerous US team. And then on top of that, you don't have Tyler Adams. So you don't have our best ball winning number six if you're going to play defensive at times. And a group that hasn't really played together as well. Now, I will say, while the results on the numbers were better, I think the U.S. performance in 2019 in the Gold Cup group stage was also plodding. And then they started to build as the tournament went along. We barely got by Curaçao, if you remember, but then played really well against Jamaica and then played well, although we lost against Mexico in the final. So I think there's a little bit of precedent for this for the U.S. because at both tournaments, you brought groups that weren't your best groups and they hadn't really been together before. And so it takes a little bit of time, but there's no reason to think. I think it's a 50-50 split, USA versus Canada, if all of the top players that have come to this tournament are available and start in that game.
Very interesting. I wanted to get to Mexico, but just before that, I thought it was really cool. Christian Roldan was on the USA bench, but Alex Roldan made his debut for El Salvador and scored against Guatemala. The dynamic there is very interesting. David, I guess, they're different places in the pecking order, but I wondered what goes into making that decision as a family unit. Like,
so I don't know if you know the rest of the story, which is they're also, the Roldans are also available to play for Guatemala. So that one parent's Guatemalan, one parent's El Salvadorian, and then they're born in the U.S. And because of Curaçao withdrawing, Alex Roldan made his debut against Guatemala, who also called him up for El Salvador. So there was even another step to it. And then he scores the game winner off the bench to open it up. So it was pretty cool. I can actually tell you from being at this MLS Next event, these federations are scouting like deep now because they know a ton of their talent pool is in the diaspora, especially in the United States. Hugo Perez is the manager for El Salvador, former U.S. international. And so he's brought Josh Perez into that group. Eric Zavaleta, as well, who made his debut earlier this year and has captained the team already and was getting into some fights against Guatemala. He had serious chip on his shoulder in that game. So it's a big part of how these national teams are building, which is awesome. And it's great. And I think that's part of the growth of the game in this region is not everyone always has to come up through your own system. But there's ways that this whole thing's connected, which is why I do think the rising tide raises all boats in terms of CONCACAF. And so it was pretty cool to see in that one. Can I just throw out a random CONCACAF thing?
Please do.
I am super excited for Jamaica versus Suriname, which will happen tonight or last night, depending on when you're listening to this, or even earlier. Those are the two teams that have the potential. Those are the two teams we know the least about, but it feels like have high ceilings. Obviously, I spoke highly of Suriname going into the Canada World Cup qualifier. Canada handled Suriname, but this is a group that none of those players had met before. And now they've had a couple of weeks to work together and they don't have to, you know, chase the game as much because remember, Canada went through with a tie for that one. So Suriname kind of had to be on the front foot early on and that exposed them. So that's really exciting. And then I haven't seen Leon Bailey play for Jamaica in 2 years, so I can't wait for that. And not, you know, Mikel Antonio hasn't come to this tournament. Not all of these dual national guys have, but Amari Bell is a part of this group who's been really good in the championship. Liam Moore, I think, as well. So a few of these guys are part of this group, and I think Jamaica should be considered one of the top two favorites to win this thing.
I think we should end where this tournament started, and maybe a baffling tournament has a baffling beginning, but Mexico and Trinidad and Tobago somehow drew 0-0, but I think Mexico had 30 shots and completed 695 passes to 151 from Trinidad and Tobago.
Insane.
Chucky Lozano got hurt and is out for 4 to 6 weeks. I have some questions about Mexico right now. I wonder if they do too, about I mean, why was he involved in this tournament is the other thing.
Because Tata Martino will get fired if they don't win this tournament.
Wowza.
And so and that's the reality of what's that's the reality of what's going on. And I think that's this is part of the problem. Is like you have a level of pressure in Mexico, and I think because of COVID, you haven't had as many chances to play and show the quality in the group. But without Raul Jimenez, this has not been a successful group. And losing the Nations League final, you put Mexico under pressure. And so they brought almost as strong a team as they could because they also had the Olympics to deal with. And I think some of the players, obviously Diego Lainez, one of them, but a few guys from the Olympic group would be in this side if they didn't have that. But otherwise, Ache's here, you know, Carlos Salcedo's here. Like, this is as good a group as Mexico could put together. And I think they feel the need to do that. And this tie is only added to that pressure. Like, you can't beat Trinidad and Tobago in Dallas, Texas, in front of your fans. This is a home game. And this is a Trinidad and Tobago FA that's a mess, let alone the team. And yeah, Mexico dominated and should have had four or five goals that they... I mean, Orbelin Pineda missed one of the best setups I've ever seen. It was a no-look scorpion layoff from Ache to set him up. And Mexico tried to walk the ball into the goal. And so that pressure is only going to grow. This is a game Mexico plays all the time, and they normally squeak out a one or two goal win. And a lot of times I would come on the show and be like, well, Mexico wasn't that good, but no one wants to see that. They just won. They weren't good, and they didn't win this time. And that's a rarity for them in this region. And so I think there's a ton of pressure, and there's a ton of intrigue, at least, to just continue to watch how this plays out for them.
Shouts to Ryan Telfer getting in that game as well for Trinidad and Tobago.
He's a baller.
CPL, he is CPL legend. Amazing. Gold Cup continues. We're planning some stuff potentially for Canada USA that we can work on and then confirm with the lot. But just know Sunday,
that, yeah, I'm gonna run that Gooch header on loop for everyone. So if Good you Lord. Tune in for that. Canada fans, be warned that you will be triggered.
That's Sunday, Canada USA. Then Thursday before that, Haiti, Canada, Martinique, USA. Should be a good week. All right. When we come back to wrap this week's show, as always, it's the mailbag. Ask AFP.
Welcome back, and now it's time for everyone's favorite segment, Ask AFP. Thanks to everyone who sent their questions this week. If you didn't get the chance to send in your own question, just hop on Twitter and use the hashtag AskAFP and send them our way. Our first question goes to Victor, and he asks, Josie Altidore is said to return to TFC practice, so it looks like the issue is resolved, guys. Will he be thrust back into the lineup?
So, Devang, can I ask you a question to follow this up to start?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think Chris Armas made that call?
No, I think he was part of the decision, but I don't think he made the main call.
So him being fired, it doesn't make sense that it would fix that because everyone else who was part of that decision is still at TFC, right?
Correct. I think the cynic in me, and perhaps this is too cynical even for me, but I look at it as where the club is in the standings, the fact that they can't seem to move him or they can't come to an agreement, and that they're coming back to Toronto and trying to draw fans or draw some interest. I think this might be the perfect storm for Josie to come back and kind of say, we're okay again. Was this their plan 10 days ago or however many days ago? Hell no, I don't think so. I think this is not desperation, but desperate times call for desperate measures. So I don't think it was totally Armas, but I think where they are right now and with the idea of them coming back to Toronto, it makes a lot of sense.
Can I say, I think it was Chris Armas' decision, but because the upper management backed them, now they can backpedal a little bit. I think that's what
for
happened.
For sure. Anyway,
I don't think Chris Armas at that point or any point had enough sway in the club to make the decision to push Josie out of the team without it being heavily discussed, if not
sure,
pushed by someone else at the club. So I would find it shocking, especially the way we've seen this club run, aka Patrick Vieira didn't want to come because he wanted more control. So they hired a manager who clearly didn't want that more control, as well as the influence we've seen from some of the top players over the last few years. that this would be totally on Armas. Now, I think to all of Devang's points, Josie can't go anywhere. There's nowhere for TFC to send him. And I don't think he really wants to go anywhere else in MLS. And it's pretty tough to get him on a team outside of MLS, especially with him not being part of the U.S. men's national team for Gold Cup. There isn't really a ton of opportunity to see him play to even appeal to teams, you know, for any sort of offer for him. So it makes sense. I think it's a professional decision by everyone to put him back in the group. It'll be fascinating how it works out, though, because I think Josie Mad is a great player.
Right. But
can you play that way if your team, like, how does his teammates feel about him, or how does anyone feel about how this went down?
And I don't know the answer to the latter part, but I think Josie with this chip, or like, I feel like he wants to show everyone he still has it, especially what he's posting on IG, and he's posting photos from like wonderful moments when he was an integral part of the team. I think he's dedicated to getting back to that level. Maybe even in spite. Hell, if it's in spite, I don't care. Like if it lights it up for TFC, that works for me. But whatever he needs to use, I think maybe they've all realized, all parties involved have realized that this is kind of where they are. And it can only get worse from here. Management must be a little more concerned about their security. So I think maybe Larry Tannenbaum's had some conversations here. I know he's very tight with, he was at least very tight with the star players of this club. So who knows where this directive is coming from. But I mean, for me, it means progress, even if it is desperation.
We didn't talk about this because we're not really doing MLS because it's not really on. But they're saying that they're coming home in 12,000 fans. At the game?
Potentially. That's pretty exciting. Which is wild. It is. And I think the Blue Jays are probably coming back as well. It's definitely a massive moment for the city. And like, I think people went nuts for Italy win as well, which is cool to see. But it's also balancing, like, I read terrible Delta variant headlines every morning, and yet we are doing well. And I remember the wave last year and not us doing well. So it's just this mix of hope and fear and trepidation. Just basic pandemic times, I guess.
Classic 2020.
Dave asks, and I'm sorry for the pronunciation of this, but do you think England regret using the Catenaccio style of play in the final game of the tournament? That's the style that Italy have played for years and years and years, but didn't in this tournament.
I think you nailed it, Nick. I think we should get a little bit of a standing up.
Appreciate it.
Nick's like, have you ever watched The Other Guys? That movie?
I have. Yes. Yeah. Great movie.
Where the guy from Boston, I can't remember his name right now, his character learns how to like legitimately dance ballet to make fun of kids who dance ballet. That's like Nick hating Italian so much that he like learned to properly pronounce everything in Italian so that he could mock them even better.
Did you call Mark Wahlberg the Boston guy? Yeah.
And I also confused The Other Guys with The Nice Guys, which was an actual good movie. The Other Guys was not. I think that was Will Ferrell.
The Other Guys is hilarious.
Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg.
No, it's pretty good.
Yeah. Will Ferrell is so funny in that movie. What is The Nice Guys?
That's with Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe, which is legitimately good. Check it out.
That was the one where they were like 70s investigators and stuff.
Yeah, right.
Not gonna lie, Ryan Gosling's a little bit too on the nose most of his movies for me at this point. You're like, oh, I get it.
That's fair. Man. You're also ducking the question.
I kind of hate La La Land, which is sort of a take.
It's not really, though, is it?
And people get upset with me. Yeah, I'm a huge musical Broadway guy.
Really? Wow. Yeah. Okay. So that's interesting.
I like love them.
You didn't think it was pure enough to the form?
Yeah, I just thought it was like, it felt like it was like a kid wrote a musical in high school and then they like took it and turned that into the movie. I just thought it was fairly basic.
Shots fired at the Oscar dominated La La Land.
Sure. Hey, put me on the Oscar boards, man. I'll clean stuff up. But back to the original question. I think that's kind of what I was talking about in the first segment, Dave. So I agree with you. And like in that game, they threw on Jordan Henderson, right? And then they finally brought on the attacking players late. And it was like, that was the moment I got upset where I was like, this is what you waited for, to put them in for penalties. Like you had at no point did you try and win this game. Throughout the way the game was played outside of the first 5 minutes when they scored. And I think that's super fresh. You have to be frustrated if you're an England fan. It's frustrating to me to watch. Yeah. It's been frustrating to watch over the course of this week. And so Yeah, I think England fans, especially after losing, will tell you, well, we didn't play well and we lost, so I don't think it was worth it the way we played.
I think I have more forgiveness for Southgate's mandate or how he wanted to play. I have less forgiveness for who he chose in the penalties or like how this went down. Like I saw Jack Grealish kind of speak out afterwards saying, like, I wanted to shoot, I wasn't chosen, Southgate's pulled all the right strings, like, I trusted him. But, like, even that, saying that to me comes across as a bit, like, don't blame me kind of thing. Henderson came off, I feel like he would have been one of the takers, someone with experience, someone who's been there for a while. Like, it's weird. He played everything so methodically for the entire tournament, and it seemed like at this point, there really wasn't a smart plan at the end. After all that, it kind of sucks.
So, yeah. There's been some really cool info out there about penalty kicks and what happened and like some research that's been done about them. Cause obviously there's been 10 million going on over the last few weeks. One of the things is they say, even though it's just a penalty kick, that your physical metrics matter at that time. That's why you see pretty much every sub will always take it for a team. Like if you come into a game, especially if it goes 120,
right.
You'll take it because you're fresh. If you remember the 06 World Cup final with France, I think it was three subs that all hit their shots. Obviously, when Zidane headbutted and then didn't play, I think it was like these Wiltord guys, and Trezeguet.
These guys
and
all came on with 119 plus. So like it was in the 119th minute. Right. Give them 10
the problem
minutes,
was,
right?
Unless you're looking at a guy who's on the roster because they are a penalty kick specialist, you got to give them a chance to get into the flow of the game. And then the other two questions are, one, is Saka the right guy in that moment? He's never taken a penalty in a professional soccer game in his life. And the other is, these were three players who have made a difference in this tournament, let alone just their careers. But in this tournament, they have made a difference. How could you not see it and say, let's give them 10 minutes to win this game? And then they go into penalties. And that's the part I think that's pretty frustrating. I think to Southgate's defense, just the comments from Grealish show what he's done for this team. Like he has changed the culture
for sure
for the English national team. I think in a way that I've never seen in my lifetime of watching the sport. Players have always been scared to play for the England team. They've always been scared of losing more than confident of winning. Southgate has changed that over the last 4 years for sure. But I don't know if the football ideas are there with him. And so now you're starting to reach a point where is he the Mark Jackson to Steve Kerr in this scenario, if that makes sense?
Mama, there goes that man. As Mark Jackson would say.
All right. And finally, Charlie asks, does the Euro result pave the way for Roberto Mancini to head back to club coaching?
Talk about a guy that could do whatever he wants now. Like legitimately, Roberto Mancini. I read a great piece from Anthony Lapopolo on The Score about what he has done for a club that missed out on the World Cup, remember, and losing to Sweden and that absolute disaster. And it's like, well, what is the future? Because we have some 90-year-old defenders and some kids who might be good going forward, but I don't know. And now, some 3 years later, they are champions of Europe. I wonder for him, though. He's been almost everywhere. He's had a pretty remarkable managerial career already. He's been to Turkey, he's been to England, he's been to Italy. Like, I think for him, it's like Russia as well in there. I could see him not going back to club football. I see it as maybe too much of a grind for a guy that's pretty accomplished as it is.
And remember, he got his contract extension before this tournament started, which I understood from like what he had already done coming into this tournament. He had already accomplished, I think, a lot of what he had to accomplish of resetting the national team, as I said, especially did it in this tournament. I thought it was odd that they gave that contract, but they clearly felt like if he had a good tournament that the options would be out there and they didn't want to end up in a bidding war against someone else. I agree with you, Devang. It feels like he's accomplished most things he wants to accomplish. And so, you know, where else do you go? The one that stands out, and obviously not from his playing career, because I think he was an Inter guy through and through and has managed them. But obviously Juventus are a bit of a mess right now. And if that reopens again, maybe in the future, that one's interesting for him. But come on, dude. This guy's posted up in like smooth blue suits. He doesn't have to work 80% of the year, and now he's a national hero.
And you go from a national hero to a local hero if you do, I think, go to a club, right? Like you lose that goodwill if you try to link up.
I think if you win something, I think, you know, like I think like Lippi, it doesn't matter, right? I think Lippi's a national hero still.
Right.
Although he didn't go back and manage clubs, so you're right. Maybe now you antagonize other fans. One of the things is with this tournament being pushed back a year and the World Cup being so close, I don't think you'll see a ton of turnover from most countries going into that World Cup because you don't have enough time to reset the calendar and you don't have a full cycle. So it's safer to keep most of your managers going forward. And I think for Mancini, you want to manage in a World Cup. So he won't be going anywhere for the next year and a half to 2 years. And that's why I brought up Juve, because if it doesn't go well now, it's Allegri, right? We've rerun on everyone, or did they not even announce that yet? Am I right?
I don't even know. I don't even know at this point.
I think it is. while I furiously Google Massimo Allegri's name, he was the manager of Serie A club Juventus. Okay. So if it doesn't work out for him in the next two seasons, basically, Mancini will be coming off a World Cup, will be available. So that's one. Although Inzaghi's also just taken over at Inter. So if it doesn't go well for him, they don't have any money, but he could also go back there. So I would say there's maybe a chance. This is the best team he's ever managed.
It's Italy. It's definitely Italy. So who the hell knows? Who the hell knows?
But this is also like, this is the best football Mancini team has ever played. They won things at City, but it was plotting and it kind of felt like underwhelming for the talent they put together, which I think we're starting to see now is one of the issues of like, you can only put 11 players on the field. So no matter how much money you spend it, there's like a ceiling to what you can do. But yeah, this was the best his teams have ever looked, which might be a credit to just his ability to manage at the international level, which is tough to put together cohesive units, or it might be that he's evolved as a manager. And so he has more to give and wants to show that at the club level week in and week out.
I can't remember which game exactly it was, but I think it was the beginning or Chiesa was struggling a bit. Maybe it was Spain and Berardi was brought up and he basically had his tracksuit off almost entirely. And it was like 30 minutes in. And it was clearly maybe a message sending kind of move and like, hey, Chiesa was on the side closest to Mancini as well. So he's definitely yelling at him every single minute of that early part of the game. But he didn't come on yet. He left him on. It worked out for him. And Chiesa ended up obviously becoming a huge member of this team going forward. But I don't know. I don't know if Mancini does that 10 years ago, right? Like, I don't know if he's doing that kind of stuff.
For sure. And I think he actually started. Berardi was the start of the first two games of the tournament.
Right.
And then, or maybe even three. Or, well, I guess the third group stage game was a rotated team. And then Chiesa came into the team. Chiesa looks like if you went into a generic pizza shop in New York and New Jersey and they just painted an Italian national team player on the wall, but not like a specific guy. That's what Federico Chiesa looks like. It is ridiculous. The guy is carved out of marble to be an Italian national team player. Obviously, his dad was an Italian national team player. So like he was actually bred for this. But it's a joke when you watch him. Also, the Euro semifinal, when they showed Mancini and Luis Enrique on the sideline, like across from each other, they are both cartoon characters of a manager of an Italian national team and a Spanish manager. Like Enrique's got the curls and the sweater vest and Mancini's got the flow and the jacket and the tie. And they just both look like what you would imagine they would look like.
Luis Enrique needed a few more pockets in his pants, maybe 10 to 15 more. I think that would have been normal. World Cup coming up soon. Hopefully Portugal's manager gets a phone that has a data plan by that time so he can surf the internet and look up tactics and stuff in the meantime. All right.
The one sad thing. So I think that it's BS. The like, oh, Belgium's golden generation hasn't won anything. They went to a World Cup semifinal for a country that's maybe done that once, but I think never.
Give it a rest, David.
But I would love to see Roberto Martinez not be the manager of that team anymore going into the World Cup. As I said, though, I doubt it happens.
Thierry Henry. Let's do it.
Okay.
All right. On that bombshell, which will surely be a disaster if that ends up happening, but we can only see so far into the future. That's it for a jam-packed edition of AFP. A reminder, a rating or review wherever you get this podcast would be great for us. Plus, We're on Twitter at A Football Pod. And as well, we are on patreon.com/A Football Podcast. Get the show early, get it ad free. Join us on the Discord. It's a great deal. Plus, once we hit our goal, which we are very close to, I think we're only 3 or 4 patrons away, more one-on-one interviews with people in and around the game of soccer. So help us out. Join us on Patreon there. For producer Dylan, for Nick, and for David, thank you so much for listening to AFP. We'll talk to you next week.